tomorrow night by the BBC Philharmonic under Gianandrea Nezeda, and that's together with the Second Symphony by Oliver Nussen, who celebrated his 60th birthday earlier this month during this year's Aldeburgh Festival. Well, Mark Elder very busy at the proms this year, of course. He was conducting on the opening night. He has two more proms still to come with the Halle. Well, there's been a street fair on Exhibition Road today, and Kensington Gardens is home to several Olympic villages. In each of our live Sunday intervals, we're hearing from the historian Dr. Lucy Worsley as she scours the area around the Royal Albert Hall for interesting things to see. And today, she's very much on her home ground at Kensington Palace to look at what can only be described as a bizarre item of clothing.
We've just climbed upstairs to the big grand state apartments at Kensington Palace, which were the beating social heart of Georgian London. Everyone who had any kind of pretensions at all would have come up to these rooms to see the king, to see the queen. But they had to be properly dressed. So I'm looking at here the female court uniform, which is called the mantua. Now, think about Cinderella films and then times it by 10. The lady who wore this is where it's an immensely wide skirt. It's about 2 metres from left side to right side, and it works by being spread out over whalebone hoops worn beneath. And it's kind of like looking at a great big piece of wallpaper. And people said this at the time. These look like architectural features rather than dresses. And with your enormously wide skirt, you had to wear lace ruffles at your forearms. You would have carried a fan. And the point of the fan actually was to show off how elegant your hands and wrists were. You had to wear white feathers on your head, these long lace lappets that spilled down the back, and high-heeled shoes like the lady's wearing here, very important. You would also be tightly sucked in around the waist. And as you can imagine, it would have taken them a couple of hours to get into these outfits for court wear. And then their job basically was to stand around chatting. And because of the weight of the dress and the tightness of the stays and the height of the heels, this was really exhausting. They used to complain about it. The lady courtiers said, "Cor, you know, I need to go home to bed. My feet are absolutely killing me." And one thing the visitors always ask, inevitably, is how did the ladies go to the loo in these dresses? And the answer is a very cunning device that looks a bit like a gravy boat or a gravy jug. And they weren't yet wearing drawers or knickers underneath these dresses. And you would retire to the anteroom and you would just pop it under and nobody would know what you were doing. However, you were supposed to go to the anteroom. You didn't do this in the drawing room with all the other courtiers. And if royal permission was not forthcoming when you asked to leave, then you just had to hold on. This is the sort of very ritualized, fossilized world of the court. You had to do what you were told. An awful lot of this involves standing up for hours and hours and hours. One time we heard that one of the court ladies said, "Look, I need to go." She was not given permission. And a few minutes later, a humiliating puddle crept out from underneath her skirt. And this is the contemporary quotation. I'm not kidding. It was said that the puddle threatened the shoes of bystanders. Now, why did the lady who wore this dress put herself through it, if you like, wearing something so uncomfortable and standing around for hours and hours? Well, she and her husband would have been at court in search of promotion and patronage and power. This is the place to be, to come and catch up on all the politics. And that's why the state apartments on what they call drawing room evenings were packed shoulder to shoulder with all of these competitive courtiers exchanging the gossip with each other. It's described as being quite unpleasant in smell. Quite a lot of sweating was going on, literally jostling for position to get near to the king and queen. And just over here, in the murky gloom of this room, we've got another shimmering silver dress jumping out of the shadows at us. This one's a bit later than the other one. The skirt's a little smaller, but you can see the silver threads sparkling out of it. And this one is very interesting and unusual because it's made out of muslin. Now, this in the 1780s was the new wonder fabric. It had been imported from India. And even, it sounds like a sort of relaxed, informal kind of a fabric to us, doesn't it? Muslin, white muslin. But it became the must-have textile for everybody at court, and they even used it for making mantuas. Now, for a dress that's really hard work to wear, very tight, very stiff, very inflexible, a muslin version was quite a welcome change, really, because it was lighter, it was fluffier. And one court lady said that the cotton muslin feels like wearing a cloud. And I guess that it did, by contrast to the stiff silk embroidered fabric of the other dress over there. And the other change here is that this dress has got a new French feature to its design, and that's that cascade of material down the back, which is called the sack back. That's not an elegant word, but it is such an elegant dress. It flows from her shoulders right down to the floor. And if you think of paintings by Watteau, for example, you'll see ladies wearing these sack back dresses. I think it is just the most elegant dress style that there's ever been.
Yeah. Dr. Lucy Worsley at Kensington Palace, and she'll be back with another quirky piece of local history next Sunday. Now, I'm joined in the Radio 3 box by a man used to extraordinary costumes, the actor Samuel West. Samuel, you've been sitting in the audience for tonight's prom. What do you think of it so far?
I think it's thrilling. I've just counted 121 people on the orchestra list, which is about a half as big again as your average concert orchestra. And I think to see those forces applied to one of my favourite pieces, The Rite of Spring, in the second half, is going to be amazing.
Well, we're going to come on to that piece a little bit later, but there's another Stravinsky piece that I gather you're looking forward to later in the proms this week.
Yeah, The Firebird. Yes, written only a year after that Mahler, which is quite shocking. What an extraordinary year 1910 must have been.
What I think is really fascinating, I guess, is the energy of those pieces. You wonder what was happening at the time to
yes,
to
I think it's the last
composers.
Flowering or the last... I'm actually doing a piece for ITV that's set in that period just before the First World War, when British society was at its most stratified, trying to keep itself together, and also, you know, was cracking in the most interesting ways in Paris and Russia and places like that. Yeah, I think it must have been an extraordinary time to live through. And also, I heard something about The Firebird the other day. It's got the most incredible ending. And I always said to somebody, I said to a musicologist the other day, why is Stravinsky's ending so good, particularly The Firebird? And he said, oh, he wrote them first. He wrote the endings first, and then he would just continue the commission until he had to stop, and then connect that up to the ending. So the ending's always good. I think that's such a good idea.
Well, it's going to be played by the Ulster Youth Orchestra and the Ulster Orchestra together in a combined prom. That's on Saturday in the afternoon.
And you get James Galway in the first half. Amazing.
Can't be better. And then in the evening, there's also an emphasis on youth on Saturday evening. There's a piece by Nico Muley, who's a
who's about
composer.
12, isn't he? He's very annoyingly
a little
talented.
Older than that, I think.
Yeah, he's wonderful. I know him because he was the Aurora Orchestra, who I've been working with recently, recorded a piece of his which went straight to number one in the classical charts. And yes, that's a new piece, so we don't know what that's going to sound like, but I'm sure it'll be thrilling.
Is that one of the draws for you about the proms, discovering pieces you didn't know before?
Yes, I've been coming to the proms since I was about seven, and I've always been very devoted to the idea of new music, because I realised quite early on that composers learned to harmonise Bach chorales when they went to music college, but they didn't write like Bach, although they could do if they wanted to. So clearly, I thought, well, okay, they're obviously into something that's new, and I don't maybe like it as much as Bach yet, but I think I should probably trust them. And I still do, I suppose.
Well, talking of Bach, Bach is appearing too this week in the proms.
Now, the B minor Mass is a piece that I suppose I'm only in the foothills of my enjoyment of so far. It's one of those huge pieces that people speak of, like, you know, the late Beethoven quartets. And I'm not fit to touch the hem of its garment yet, but I have just... bought the second of three recordings by the Collegium Vocal Ghent. And I think it's fascinating that their conductor has returned to the same piece now three times. My father's played King Lear three times, and every time he says, oh, I haven't got it right yet. And, you know, when you've made a great success of a role or a piece or a recording, you know, Glenn Gould didn't need to go back and do another Goldberg Variations. He was a star when he was 20 from having done it the first time. But I love it when people go, oh, no, it's far bigger than me.
Well, we're going to hear a snippet to hear just how big it can be. This is one of the choruses, Cum Sancto Spirito. It's performed by the Dunedin Consort and Players, directed by John Butt. Cum Sancto Spiritu from Bach's B minor Mass, and that piece is going to be performed here at the Proms on Thursday, starting at 7:30. Harry Bickett and the English Concert, and a fine selection of soloists.
Yes, including Yestyn Davis, who I'm an enormous fan of, not just because he has one of the most beautiful countertenor voices out there, but also because he's a thoroughly nice chap. I shall certainly be tuning into that.
Samuel West, you're not just a kind of prommer or an audience member at the Proms, you take part as well.
Yes, I've done a few. I did the last night in 2002, which was very exciting and only a little bit terrifying. And I'm doing a tiny narration for a new piece in one of the chamber proms on the 18th of August called The Garden of Earthly Delights by Simon Bainbridge. Again, with Nick Collin of the Aurora Orchestra, who I've been working with a lot this summer. Yes, it's odd. I've been doing a lot of music. I did a Jonathan Harvey piece called Veldethos, and I've just worked with Graham Fitkin for the first time.
And you did some stuff at Aldbrough as well.
Yeah, I did the Britain, all the Britain Auden films, Night Mail, The Way to the Sea, The King's Stamp, I mean, stuff that's quite far down on anyone's repertoire, but no, I love it. I love working with musicians as well, because they're unarguably talented, which isn't always true of actors.
And Britten in particular, do you have a feeling for his music, an interest in
his
kind of period
and
of writing?
And his politics and his worldview. I'm a pacifist, and so was he. I think it's a very good time to be thinking about peace and togetherness at a celebration of the Olympics, and also of youth, which gives us all energy and hope and takes away so much of our cynicism. But also because, in the credits of Nightmare, it says words by Britten. Words by Auden, music by Britten, and they don't even and starring the men of the LMS. I mean, they don't even use their first names. It's that socialist. I love it.
and Tippett too is going to feature in the Proms this week.
Yes, they're doing the Child of Our Time, that beautiful oratorio for repressed people everywhere, which I think was the first time I came upon the use of Negro spiritual in classical music, and sounds like it could be a very sort of ill-fitting coat, but he does it quite beautifully. I actually discovered that piece just after I'd played Tippett in a radio play about him, just after he'd been released from prison as a conchi, and started conducting the orchestra at Morley College, which was mostly made up of unemployed silent film musicians who'd been out of work since the coming of sound in the early 30s, including the father of the person who wrote the radio play. And it just seemed like a sort of wonderful thing for somebody to do, to keep all these people in work and hope. So I've been a fan of him ever since, really.
Well, A Child of Our Time you can hear on the 1st of August, and it introduces another new ensemble of young performers, the BBC Proms Youth Choir, and we've been hearing about the prom from a couple of the members.
I'm Sophie Hill, I'm 16 years old, I live in Solihull in the West Midlands, and I'm part of the BBC Proms Youth Choir.
And I'm Yeyan Jones, and I'm 17 years old, I'm from Rose-on-Sea in North Wales.
BBC Proms Youth Choir is a new choir that's been set up this year. It's bringing together five existing youth choirs from Birmingham, the north of England, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales.
I think I'm looking forward most to performing in the Albert Hall, because I've never been there personally before. I've heard about how the acoustics are in the Albert Hall and how vast it is, so I'm really excited about that.
We're singing Sir Michael Tippett's A Child of Our Time for the prom on the 1st of August. It was written during the Second World War, so the music was written with the intention of getting a point across about how wrong the war was. So the music doesn't always sound particularly jolly.
I think the favourite part for us as a choir are the spirituals in the piece. Lots of the piece is quite hard to sing, the harmonies are very hard, and we were quite horrified when we saw the piece for the first time. But the more we've sung it, the more we've got into it and the more enjoying it. And I think the spirituals are something we'd like to carry on with after the proms.
And you can hear the Proms Youth Choir singing A Child of Our Time by Tippett alongside works by Ives, Barber and Zimmerman on Wednesday evening at 7:30. Well, that applause is for members of the Aldborough World Orchestra just making their way back onto the stage, and a particularly powerful piece in the second half.
Oh yeah, I'm completely addicted to the Rite of Spring, especially live. I mean, it sends my pulse through the roof. It's one of the best natural highs out there. I always try and catch it at the Proms. I've seen it with a number of youth orchestras. It should never be a sort of standard piece of repertoire, it seems to me. It should always come bleeding off the page. It shouldn't be that thing you play before you go to the pub. And a youth orchestra is never old enough to have it completely under their belts. So it takes them up and squeezes them out and completely terrifies them, which is exactly the way it should be. I mean, it should sound like it was written last Thursday.
And a very theatrical piece.
Yeah, I mean, two timpanis. Even if you can't see them, you can hear them going mad. And in this case, you know, a fast orchestra working their socks off. I think it's really important that a youth orchestra is not too prim either. I saw the NYO do it in ball gowns once. Not the men. Perhaps that was a mistake. That would have been interesting, actually. Perhaps that's where they went wrong. But they're wearing black tonight, and a lot of women are in trousers, which seems to me a good idea.
Yeah, pretty fitting. I really like the energy of the players, just watching them perform. They're really sitting on the edge of their seat, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah. Well, I mean, this is a piece that you have to for. There are easy bits. But then, you know, you actually can never really afford to stop counting them. Famous bit at the beginning of the second half where you've had 15 minutes off and suddenly Stravinsky comes in and bashes you over the head with a 7-5 or something.
Well, Samuel West, thank you very much for joining me.
Such
We're certainly
pleasure.
Looking forward to that piece, and of course Charlotte Bray, who's new commissioner, is going to open the second half.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. You know, all three new BBC commissions in the next week are by women. That would have been unheard of when I started Promi, and now it's not even unusual. It's wonderful.
It's a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
And let's hear many more in the future. Well, Samuel West, thank you very much. And
cheers.
As you can hear, the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall are making their way back to their seats or their standing places in the arena, ready for the second half of this concert given by the Aldeburgh World Orchestra. Conductor Mark Elder making his second appearance of the season here at the Royal Albert Hall. He's a great supporter of young musicians, performers and composers. And before the climax of tonight's concert, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, the Aldeburgh World Orchestra perform a world premiere, a BBC commission, as we said, from Charlotte Bray, listed in the Evening Standard's 1,000 Most Influential Londoners as an outstanding composer talent of her generation. She's created a work for the orchestra that's strongly influenced by Benjamin Britten and his home on the Suffolk coast, although the initial motif came from Literature, a poem by one of Picasso's muses, who was also a surrealist writer.
There's a poem by Dora Maar that particularly inspired this piece, and the last line of that is, "The hummingbird motionless as a star." So this idea really struck me as something that I could try and transform musically. So the title of the piece, At the Speed of Stillness, is a metaphor for that, really, that something could be moving so fast but still be perceived as still. So the piece in general is very fast, but there are moments where there's a layer of stillness over very fast-moving, quiet material.
And there's something particular about Aldeburgh involved in the piece too.
Yeah, that's right. Another part of inspiration for the piece came from Aldeburgh as well. After spending a lot of time in Aldeburgh, part of the countryside that I've always ignored is the power pylons that chase across the countryside from Sizewell Power Station. And when I started to think about this inspiration, it really became quite powerful. And it's the endless energy and really the zinging power you get, especially when you stand close. Also, other things led into the piece. For example, the duality of the pylons that are always in sync, and in parts of the landscape they totally line up in view, which I just took very abstractly in musical terms. So you quite often have two melodic lines alongside each other.
Charlotte Bray, who's intent on capturing the perception of permanence that underlies rapidly changing impressions and exploring a paradoxical use of sound, giving the sensation that material is moving faster than the ear can hear and so seems not to move at all. She likens it to the way the image of a spinning train wheel can give the impression that it's motionless. Well, Charlotte has really enjoyed the opportunity presented by this large orchestra to explore a wide range of musical textures. And she said it was great to be able to spend 2 weeks working intensely with the players. Well, here to conduct them, Mark Elder, in At the Speed of Stillness by Charlotte Bray.
Thank you.
At the Speed of Stillness by Charlotte Bray, the world premiere given here at the Proms by the Aldborough World Orchestra under Sir Mark Elder. Sir Mark, quick to ask the flute section to stand. And those cheers are for Charlotte Bray. She studied with Mark Anthony Turnage. He commented on how easy she was to teach, simply soaking up all his suggestions. And Mark Elder greeting her with a kiss on each cheek. And Charlotte Bray shaking hands with the leader. She's written for Aldborough before. Vers de Venise was a co-commission from the Aldborough Verbier and Aix-en-Provence festivals. And her new chamber opera, Making Arrangements, is due to be premiered this week by Tête-à-Tête Opera at Riverside Studios. So quite a week for her. Looking further ahead, Charlotte says she has a new commission from the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra's Youth Orchestra. That's for 2013. But actually, she said, it's been hard to concentrate on anything other than this moment. As Samuel West pointed out, the first of three Proms commissions from female composers in this week alone at the Proms. All the musicians that have come together in this Aldborough World Orchestra have been very excited to work on this piece. For many of them, it's the first time they've tackled contemporary music, but they've certainly done so with relish. Charlotte appreciative of them and they of her. All the string players tapping their bows as Charlotte makes her way off the platform. Well, certainly they've learnt a lot from working with a composer and from such an eminent conductor as Mark Elder, but I wondered what he's learnt from them.
I've learnt, if they're allowed to, how far they can go in their music making. I've learnt never to be satisfied with anything other than the best. I've learnt to put the bar a bit higher almost every day, to go on demanding, to see how far they can go. And this is particularly interesting with the people who are not so experienced. Because we had time, we had some wonderful coaches for the individual sections, and I worked alongside them, and we developed the ideas about how the orchestra should sound and how they needed to work together. Before the first concert, the violin tutor said to the first violins, just go into a room together and play the difficult passages calmly and quietly together, just to remind yourselves who you are. You're a one section and you get on very well. The double bass mentor said the same thing. Just go and be in a room and just warm up together. So the double basses went into the room and played football with their rosin.
Well, clearly, whatever their nationality, the characteristics of the different sections of orchestra will out. For their final piece in tonight's prom, the Aldborough World Orchestra turned to a savage animal of the repertoire. At least that's how leader Abigail Bushakovitz describes it, saying no matter how familiar you are with it, it's always a heart-palpitating feeling to play it. Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. It first outraged its first audience in Paris in 1913, and though the riot in the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées stemmed in part from the sound of what for many marks the beginning of modern music, Stravinsky was actually writing in the tradition of grand 19th century Russian scores. His inspiration was the full force of a Russian spring, with the earth cracking and glaciers melting, turning streams into raging torrents, combined with a pagan ritual that's bloody, primitive and elemental. Stravinsky's vision came to him in a dream. I saw in my imagination, he said, a solemn pagan rite, wise elders seated in a circle, watching a young girl dance herself to death. They're sacrificing her to propitiate the god of spring. The work is in two parts, the adoration of the earth and the sacrifice. Stravinsky wrote the work for Diaghilev's Ballet Russe, and Diaghilev encouraged him to score the work for a much larger orchestra than a ballet would normally call on. And here to conduct the Aldborough World Orchestra is Sir Mark Elder. This is Stravinsky's Rite of Spring.